Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern. I am joined by Heidi White and Tim McIntosh. Heidi and Tim, welcome back to the show. How's it going?
It's going great. I almost lost my headset today. And then that would have been sad because then I have to use my other ear pods that echo. But then they were in my daughter's spider bathroom. So my daughter, she has...
Yeah, can you just go ahead and instead of flying past that?
There's a bunch of leaves that have just been buried.
So Lucy has this bathroom that she doesn't want any spiders to die in the house. And so she catches them and puts them in her bathroom. So that is where the headset was.
Your daughter is a unique young woman.
So like, hold on a second though. Hold on. That's weird. Like, that's a pretty strange thing. Like, she collects the spiders. She puts them in a spider room. She's keeping them. She's nurturing them.
She doesn't want me to kill them. Yeah. Right. Like
she wants you to die instead. So,
right. Thank you.
So, but this is the weird part here. All of that's fine and strange and the subject of a great story and I love it and I'm fine with it. But why was your headset in the spider bathroom?
Well, I have theories on that, several theories. I'm not really sure. Lucy tells me that the only thing she's put in the spider bathroom are spiders and not my headset. So I think it was my son.
Yeah,
I think it was Jack. And I think it was because he borrowed my headset without asking, which is fine, in order to play Fortnite. So he's only allowed to play Fortnite
In the spider room.
I think so. 2 times a week, he's allowed to play with his buddy from his class at school. And it's like he has 1 hour to play Fortnite, which is apparently not enough time, but I don't care. So I don't know because the iPad and the headset were in the spider bathroom. So I have some things to follow up with and I'll keep y'all posted.
Yeah. So there's a podcast I listen to at the end of it. They have something called Parent Corner where two guys tell stories about how terrible their kids are. So we might need to start something about how interesting our kids are.
Right. Could I just float another theory out there for you, Heidi, that maybe...
I was going to turn to you and ask if you had any theories on this.
Right.
What if the spiders are just like, you know, huge Graham Greene fans?
Oh man.
Or wow, let's take
now
it
I'm having like a Ron Weasley moment. Yeah. No,
what if in Spider World, Spider-Verse, the spiders in your daughter's spider bathroom are hosting the alternative Spider World Close Reads podcast?
This is my favorite theory. I like this one best.
I don't know, this is
an unfolding saga.
Yes, it is.
I think probably we should dedicate this whole episode to that. But our listeners have expectations. So we are going to
set our
episode today actually meeting the expectations of our listeners. And their expectation is that we're going to answer their questions about Graham Greene's The Power and the Glory. So I think we should do that.
We should.
You have sent your questions in via Facebook and by email and such. So we have plenty to talk about today. Just want to remind everybody that if you would like to be able to do that in the future, you can send in questions via email to us at closereadspodcasts@gmail.com. That's our new email address for that. Or you can do so on the Facebook page. A couple of people emailed me asking me about how they could get to the Facebook page. And all you got to do is go to facebook.com and type in Close Reads in the search bar and they should pop up. If you can't find it, you can email and we can send you the direct link. But it should be pretty easy to find and you can join that and we will approve you as a member and you can take part in the wonderful conversation that is happening over there. Also, please make sure that you are subscribing and that you are writing reviews and that you are leaving starred reviews. Please do so. If you have not done that in a while or ever, please do leave us a review. I can't overstate how much that helps us out when you leave those kind of that kind of feedback. It helps our egos when you give us good feedback, but it also helps the algorithms that help people find us and get us higher up on the charts and help us continue to make these. We are happy to make these for the 7 of you who normally listen, but we'd probably be best if we continue to grow the audience. And you can help us do that by making sure you have clicked that subscribe button on whatever app you use, or by leaving a starred review or a written review, both of which help us immensely. So, okay, that stuff's out of the way. Let's talk about the power and the glory. We have a number of questions. Tim, the thing is, though, you didn't get to tell us how you were yet. So I want to.
I'm great. I'm tip top terrific. I'm right in the middle of my writing season. And so all I think about from the time that I wake up until the time I go to bed is writing speeches. And now I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm not there yet, but I can see it, and I will be doing much better then. I won't be completely preoccupied with just generating. Can I just tell you guys, I don't know if I said this last week, I calculated how many pages I've written in the last 5.5 weeks, 170 pages.
Oh, wow.
Which is a lot. It's a lot.
That's a lot. How much cutting and pasting do you think? From one page to another.
Wait, what do you mean? What do you mean?
Like, do you have a template that you, or do you write each one individually?
Oh, no, I write each one individually. No, that's a slight exaggeration. There's one of the speeches that is kind of part of the package that I produce is templated.
Okay.
Templated. But all of the other ones.
That's amazing, Tim. You should be really proud of yourself. Good job.
It's exhausting.
I'm sure.
So exhausting. Anyway.
Is it as exhausting as running from a evil lieutenant in 1930s?
It's not that exhausting.
Okay. Well.
but I find myself wanting to do not stupid things, but like wanting to watch Netflix comedy series because I'm just so brain dead that I can't really concentrate on anything else.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the power and the glory.
Yeah, let's ask you to concentrate on that. Okay, so first question here. What do you guys make of the one, this is from Tawny, what do you make of the one word Tench hears the whiskey priest say at his execution, that being excuse? And is it a noun or a verb, she asks. Heidi, you go first.
Yeah, I really like this question, and I fully intended to Google this and figure, because as I
can rely on somebody else to answer it.
Exactly. Rely, but then I'm forced back on my own thoughts. So I have assumed in the times that I have read this novel, so I do not know this, but I have assumed that it's some kind of reference to a contrition prayer or some kind of something like that that was just misunderstood. By Tench, but it was something in the context of his prayers of contrition and repentance as he goes to the firing squad. But that is pure speculation on my part.
I speculated the exact same way. The exact same way.
Hmm.
Do you have something different, David?
No. One thing that it does say is that, you know, perhaps his mouth was too dry because nothing came out except a word that sounded like excuse. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, if you wanted to do like a psychological reading, you could start thinking about like, is Tench projecting something when he sees, based on what he may or may not be hearing? I think you could read that word either way. I think this is a classic example of Graham Greene not giving us an answer, but giving us possibility, you know?
Yes.
And
yes.
I like, you know, Erica responded on Facebook. She mentioned that she read it as a reference to the Spanish perdonar, which means to forgive and also to excuse, depending on the context. So, you know, I think that's certainly an interesting take. And I think it's probably something to that. But I do think Green, you know, I think a lot of our answers to these questions are going to be, well, Graham Greene is not really in the business of giving us answers. He's in the business of giving us possibilities, which is why his work has lasted.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, either way, it's an intentional word, right? That calls to mind either making excuses for oneself or begging for pardon in some way. Yeah. And being in the request to be excused. And both of those go along with the Graham Greene's subtext throughout this whole novel. Hmm.
I do. It is interesting and dramatic to imagine him, like, as he's about to get shot, he's almost like trying to say, excuse, like, stop. You know, he's like almost trying to put his hands up right as they're going to shoot him. So there's some pathos in that as well. Like, he's trying to express something one way or the other, but it's being taken in through Tench's perspective. So that kind of colors it a little bit. We're not in his head anymore, which is interesting that we get in his head but then in the final moments, we're not in his head anymore. We're in the perspective of somebody who's not even that close to it, right? So, okay. Aaron asks, is Baby Kern here yet? As of this recording, no, he's not here yet. We're recording Wednesday it's 4 o'clock Wednesday. That's Eastern time. And as of now, she is officially a day late and she should hurry up and make her presence. She's made her presence known for a long time, but she should,
reveal herself.
Yeah. So, thanks for asking, Aaron. And thanks to everyone who has been checking in on us. We appreciate that. Okay. Speaking of daughters, Ilya, I think it's Ilya, asks, why does the priest see his daughter as completely irredeemable? He manages to hold hope for just about everyone, even the lieutenant and the mestizo, and yet seems to take it as absolute fact that his own daughter, whom he wishes to redeem more than any other person, is hopelessly lost. Is that his own conviction blinding him, or are we supposed to believe it is true? And then Heidi says, this is a fantastic question. So Heidi, therefore, you get to answer it first.
I loved this question because this is my main unanswered question for this novel, is this exact question. As most of our listeners know, it's one of my favorite novels. I've read it several times, but this question haunts me. And I think there were so many of the questions that were asked by the readers that were interpretive questions that I'm sure we've all had, right? That were like, I don't know what to make of that. That is still a question mark in my mind. And this is one of them. I think part of that could be addressed with the issue of that the child was conceived in mortal sin, and therefore perhaps there's some, you know, sense in the priest. Although this is not Catholic theology necessarily, there may be some sense in him that because she's been conceived in mortal sin, that she carries a greater burden of original sin, but that would be entirely in his own mind, right? So, and in his fear, his guilt, whatever is coloring that. Or the question she asked at the end, are we supposed to believe that this is true? I'm not convinced that we're supposed to believe this is true. And in many cases, the priest has shown himself to be an unreliable narrator. And so maybe we don't have to believe that. Maybe that is a misconception that the priest has. So I love this question, and I'm going to leave it as a question because this is my main unanswered question of the novel as well.
And Heidi, you're confident that he, let me back up. I apparently did not read this part closely enough, because I have been reading it as he's just afraid of his daughter existing in the world, and especially without her father being around, a kind of magnified worry that probably every father has, but he just feels it more acute because he knows that he's not going to be around. But you think, and the person who asked the question thinks, it's graver than that?
Well, and I'm trying to find it. I'm flipping through. David, if you find it.
207 and 208 is where he last thinks about her. Here, yeah. I'll go ahead and read it while you're looking.
Yeah.
So it's where the priest sits on the floor. He's got the brandy. And it's right before his dream. As the liquid touched his tongue, he remembered his child. Coming in out of the glare, the sullen, unhappy, knowledgeable face. He said, oh God, help her. Damn me, I deserve it, but let her live forever. This was the love he should have felt for every soul in the world, all the fear and the wish to save concentrated unjustly on the one child. He began to weep. It was as if he had watched her from the shore drown slowly because he had forgotten how to swim. He thought, this is what I should feel all the time for everyone. And he tried to turn his brain away toward the half-caste, the lieutenant, even a dentist he had once met or once sat with for a few minutes. The child at the banana station calling up a long succession of faces, pushing at his attention as if it were a heavy door which wouldn't budge. For those were all in danger, too. He prayed God help them. But in the moment of prayer, he switched back to his child beside the rubbish dump, and he knew it was for her only that he prayed. Another failure.
Right. Well, in the mother, Maria, she gives the child, the Brigida, the most, like the strongest words of condemnation that anybody does in the novel.
Much earlier, right?
Yes, on page 79.
What did she say?
She says, she'll never be good for anything. You can see that. He replies, she can't be very bad at her age. And then, and she'll go on the way she's begun. That's Maria again. And he said, the next mass I say will be for her. Hmm. She wasn't even listening. She said, she's bad through and through. He was aware of faith dying out between the bed and the door. And there's another point in the novel in which he seems to agree with Maria's assessment of the child. He says he could see that the world is in her heart, like a spot of decay in fruit. But the strongest words of condemnation really do come from Maria, the own mother, her own mother, the child's own mother. But you're right. Some of it is just his fear. And maybe that is, maybe he's so afraid that he can't see past his fear, but he does seem to be more condemning of the child than he is of anybody else in the novel. Would you guys agree with that?
Condemning.
Yeah, yes. That's a tough, I'm not sure I follow that.
Condemning is maybe too strong, more like giving up on. Maybe condemning is way too strong because condemning implies malice.
But yeah. is this passage I read even about other people as much as it is about him?
No, that's a great question.
Like, I don't believe Green is suggesting something about these other characters so much as it's suggesting something about
his
own self-consciousness, his own fear. So like, because he's processing his own selfishness, and for him to even think of her above anyone else, you know, to be primarily concerned with her and not other people is a selfishness. That's a sin in of itself is what he's saying.
Right. Yeah.
That it doesn't seem to me that this is a passage that's about her. It's a passage that's about him. It's about him coming to terms with himself. It's a sort of confession about his own selfishness. And I don't personally see it as a condemnation of her.
Condemnation was the wrong word. I guess he does seem to be the most worried about her salvation. He doesn't seem to see her he has this desperate love and fear for her, but what he sees in her is this, the world is in her heart like decay in fruit. And he is so afraid she's going to be lost, not just because she's in a scary world, but because of something in her.
Well, I mean, so how does that balance out with some of the things we talked about with Coral? Because I mean, this book is about decay, you know?
Yes, right. Right. Well, and I think that those two are juxtaposed. Those two characters are juxtaposed with each mm-hmm. other in a right. way that we, mm-hmm. yeah. these two girls, but he doesn't even remember Coral's name, but she's the one who's saved, right? But he has this desperate love for his daughter, but somehow he knows, and I'm putting, you know, look, see my air quotes. I'm not saying he really knows it, but he, quote, knows that she's going to be lost. And Ilya's question is why? Why is that? And I don't know.
Wait, I still don't. Wait, he know? What do you mean he knows she's going to be lost?
He talks as if he is convinced in his own heart that Brigida is lost.
I hear that in the novel.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, I think the there's just a distinction between someone who knows he's not going to be around and fearing that might happen, as opposed to like believing that that might happen, that that's what's happened.
As opposed to like a deep confidence that it's inevitable or something like that.
Yeah. So like he knows he's not going to be around. He knows that, that what's the things she's surrounded by and the things that she has at her disposal are not like without some great, some kind of great grace, that she's going to be ultimately in trouble. But isn't that kind of what the book's about? Like the, that without that kind of great grace, that's what everyone's the inevitability for everyone. And that's why in the end, the book is just sort of fundamentally hopeful because the priest returns, you know, there's always the church, that that new priest comes and the boy kisses his hand. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, you know, ultimately the book is about how there is that sort of grace available.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
I don't know. I think we maybe probably more, we more agree than anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a tough one to answer. So we're going to move on now. Unless either of you wants to add something. Mm-mm. Okay. So Brandon asks, I assume jokingly, which character is the power and which is the glory? But then that got me thinking, like, that's kind of actually an interesting question. So what do you make of the title?
Tim, you got to go first on this one.
An allusion to the Lord's Prayer.
Sure. Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And I think the whole book is, the opposite. It's like a demonstrable opposite to any sense of God's power and glory on earth and any sense of demonstrable power and glory for God's church until we kind of get a glimmer of what at the end of the book of what the priest's suffering has brought about in the world. So I think it's a, obviously it's an allusion to the Lord's Prayer. And I think it's kind of a wink at what that, it's a glance at what that actually looks like in real time in a horrible situation, living under an oppressive power.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Right. Yeah. I catch that too, the play on words there. It's, there's no question mark in the title, but it's the title connected to this particular story raises a lot of questions.
Yeah. Right?
So what do you mean by power? What do you mean by glory? Is it that the lieutenant represents earthly power and the priest represents this eternal glory, or is, I mean, that's certainly an interpretive option. But yeah. I think there's more to it than that. I think it's raising questions about the nature of power, whether earthly or divine, and the ultimate results, you know, what is glory?
And, you know, I think the ending tells us a lot as well. So if it's about the nature of power, then you're kind of looking at the nature of powers, right?
Yes.
One thing being more powerful than the other. And ultimately we get the suggestion that the sort of highest power is the power of grace and God's grace and God's love and God's glory, ultimately, because the final image we get is this priest coming back. And I think that, you know, that's, or this new priest arriving, and that's, you know, Green wants that to linger for a reason. So whatever the power is, the lieutenant wields, whatever power that the, this oppressive regime, impressive as well, wields, is not as powerful as, you know, this sort of ultimate power.
But yeah.
It's a sort of ultimate power that is shrouded in an ultimate glory. And, that it's a glory that's why I think that the book talks, you know, there's this sort of running theme of the sort of image of God in this book, even if it's mm-hmm. not directly. And I think that that's tied to this sense of glory. And I also think that this is a kind of a journey book, right? There's a quest going on here. And I think that's the title is playing into that as well, that this is a character who is constantly in search of both power and glory in both a negative and positive senses.
Hmm.
And I think that he is after the glory, the kind of glory that God gives us, and the kind of power, but you know, in the same way he has wielded power as a priest before, and he has had respect and a sort of glory, but you know, there's that dichotomy between good glory and bad glory, and even between power and glory. I think all those things are at play, which is, you know, this book was not originally published in America as The Power and the Glory.
Yeah, we mentioned that during the first episode, didn't we?
Yeah.
It was his labyrinthine ways.
It's the labyrinthine ways. Yeah.
Wow. That doesn't work as well. Power in the glory.
And just getting that middle word out of your mouth is just such a labor.
It is. Yeah.
You started to make a joke, didn't you, David? Did you think better of it right in the middle of it?
Yeah. You know, we'll move on. Some jokes are less funny than others, or they're only funny to the person who's saying them. So Ilya asks another question. She says, why is the priest so ruled by his fear of the pain of death if the rest of the pains of life don't seem to affect him? The man in the jail cell says a toothache is worse than being shot. We see the priest with the worst teeth Tench has ever seen, enduring fever, starvation, injury, etc., and not even giving them much notice until they affect his ability to function. And yet the fear of pain drives him all the way to the end. Why is that?
And it's another great question.
You know, I'm going to, there's part of the question that I'm going to dispute that he doesn't, okay, I'm looking at the online. He's enduring fever, starvation, injury, doesn't give them much notice until they affect his ability to function. I don't know about that. I think that he is hurting, and I think he does complain about it. It may not be like the chief preoccupation of his interior monologues, but boy, I sure remember a lot of occasions where he's hurting and he gives voice to it. And I think the book is about him struggling to overcome those pains, exhaustion, et cetera, to continue his task. But I don't know that he doesn't complain about them or that they don't bother him.
Right. Well, the life of these people is particularly characterized by physical hardship, right? We talked about that a lot in the beginning of the discussion on this book, that this is a poverty-stricken area in which the people suffer from the land. We talked a lot at the very beginning of the podcasts about this book, about, you know, the land, the heat, the water, the disease, the oppressive nature of the landscape. And so some of it may be just they're used to it, right? Like it's not the same, you know, like if it dips below 70 degrees, I'm like freezing and complete. You know, if I don't get a snap,
you should live in the state you live in.
Right. Thank you. This is an ongoing conversation.
Also,
I have.
Also, you should probably not live in the state in the United States that you live in.
Yeah, it's true. I'm just like a big giant baby about physical hardship, but because I live in because I have the option of being comfortable all the time. These people don't. Like, there's no sense of that.
They've developed thicker skins.
Yeah. So maybe some of it is that. But I think the point that she's bringing up is valid. It's that, you know, he's sitting in the jail cell and he's uncomfortable, but he's not demanding that because he's a priest, he should have a more comfortable place. Why don't you guys make room for me? You know, like there is a sense of acceptance of the fact that his life is characterized by suffering, which I think in some ways goes to the idea of penance, maybe. And that he's kind of terribly uncomfortable and suffering in his body as a way of kind of expiating this sacramental call, you know, life that he has. Like, he doesn't want to. And so in some sense, if he's uncomfortable, he's paying for that in some way. He doesn't say that, though. That's not really a tone of the novel. So maybe I disagree with myself.
It's interesting how even to the end, he is consumed with, is it going to hurt to die?
Yeah, for sure. So
what do you think of that? Like, he even asks the lieutenant at the end, you know, you've seen a lot of people get shot. How long does the pain last? Why is he so consumed with that specific idea of, like, how long is the pain going to last? How much is it going to hurt? I mean, besides the fact that everybody's probably consumed with that to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Right. Maybe
I took it as just I took it just the simple face value. He does not want to endure a long, difficult death.
Yeah.
Like, is there something spiritually going on there? Maybe that seems like that's the looming question. Is there something?
Right. Is it symbolic of something? Is it kind of getting some of that Graham Greene subtext? I didn't read it that way. I read it in a very simple human, I'm afraid of being in pain.
Whereas he certainly worries about the state of his soul. Certainly. I think that, and those two things are not completely separate from each other, but I think his worry about the longevity of being shot, the pain of being shot, is the same worry that I would have if I were facing a gun. Man, is this going to take a long time? Is this going to really hurt? I hope not.
I think what it does is Graham Greene was also a screenwriter. And I think when you're working in areas where, say you're writing a screenplay or a play, you're always looking for like, what are lines? What are things that they're going to say that can humanize them? Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways it does that, you know, in a screenplay, as far as the audience is concerned, I mean, you have to have them do something or say something that makes them seem more human. In a novel, you can describe it or get in their head a little bit more or whatever. But I think that the biggest accomplishment there is it makes him seem like a real person. Definitely. I think at times he can feel A, like an sort of archetype, or B, like sort of like a cipher, you know, but but these kind of things make him seem like a real person who has real fear. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes him seem like a real human being.
Mm-hmm. Right. I agree.
Let's see. You guys want to move on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Taro asks, or Tara, what was going on with the dream the priest remembered during mass in the middle of part 3, chapter 1? I took it as a premonition of what was going to happen next, i.e. the return of the half-caste, but it seemed very strange.
This is the dream where he is, correct me if I'm wrong, remembering. It's a dream of him doing his priestly functions. He's remembering kind of some of his studies. Is that correct? Is that the dream that we're talking about?
Well, part 3, chapter 1 is when he's in the jail.
It's what she said here. She said it backwards from what I've been saying. She said chapter 1, part 3. So I think that's what she's... part 3, chapter 1.
Well, it says...
Not part 1, chapter... chapter 1, part 3.
Well, her comment says part 3, chapter 1.
Yeah.
But there's a couple different dreams. There's one that he has... If she's talking about the one during mass, well, Graham Greene uses dreams a lot in all of his novels. Someone is having dreams that are very, very symbolic. So every single one of them is significant. The one when he, in part 3, chapter 1, when he's in jail, he has a dream. And then there's also one in which he's sitting at a table with the women in the altar guild.
That's the one that I was thinking of, the second one. Which one do you think that she's talking about, Heidi?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We could talk about both of them, I guess.
Well, let's see here. So part 3.
There's one when he can't remember the password. That's the one when he's in the jail.
Yeah, but let's see. So everyone can feel free to just skip ahead 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Part 3, chapter 1. So he's with... That's when he's with the Lairs.
No. Okay. Yeah, you're right. Is that page 92? Or no.
I'm looking at...
I know what she's talking about.
What's she talking about, Heidi?
Hold on. Is it when he's in mass? Okay. I don't have a table of contents. Part 2, chapter 1. I just have to thumb through because my book doesn't have a table of contents.
Part 3, chapter 1 is like 172 in that range. And that's when he's doing the mass in the town where the Lairs live.
Oh, okay.
That's the one. That's the one.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to find the specific dream, though.
Okay, in my page 178, actually, it begins 177. he had no vestments but the masses in this village. He remembered a dream that he had of a big grassy area lined with the statues of the saints, but the saints were alive. They turned their eyes this way and that, waiting for something. He waited too with an awful expectancy. Bearded Peters and Pauls with Bibles pressed to their breasts watched some entrance behind his back he couldn't see. It had the menace of a beast. Then a marimba began to play, tinkly and repetitive. A firework exploded and Christ danced into the arena, danced and postured with a bleeding face, the bleeding painted face up and down, grimacing like a prostitute, smiling and suggestive. He woke with a sense of complete despair that a man not might feel finding the only money he possessed was counterfeit.
It's 176
Yeah.
Or this is a dream within a, like he's remembering a dream within a specific moment.
Right.
So, like right. There's layers of reality going on here.
Right. So I have always read that as being his temptation to leave Tabasco and go and become what he once was. That the Christ that he's seeing is a false Christ. Mm. The Christ in the dream is a false Christ who's tempting him back to this false life, the life of pride and being fake.
Well, and right before that, he says, it says a virtuous man can almost cease to believe in hell, but he carried a hell about with him. Sometimes yes. At night he dreamed of it. Evil ran like malaria in his veins. And then the line you said, he remembered a dream that he had had of a big... So he's saying that that dream is about hell.
Yes. Yeah, but the hell within him, right? The hell of being tempted to go back to the sickness of his pride and the falsity of the life that he lived before this purifying experience, that's actually going to lead him to the cross, right? The true cross. So if he goes back, I'm thinking about that whole idea of once you have tasted of heavenly glory, if you go back, you're lost, right? So that, I think that's always how I've interpreted this dream, as he's now, he could just leave and go back, but he, as she points out, this is what he could choose instead of going forward when the mestizo comes and tells him that there's a man who needs your prayers.
Well, it's also about the idea that what he's always believed in is false, right? And he says that he woke with a sense of complete despair that a man might feel finding the only money he possessed was counterfeit. So that like the dream sort of makes a mockery of the things that he's believed in. And then, but then right after that, he gets to the point in the mass where he says, so he wakes up and then he realizes he's remembering that he remembers when he wakes up. And then he says in the mass, and we saw his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Mass was over.
Right. Well, and then he talks about 3 days, right?
Yeah. So, that paragraph might be worth reading. Do you guys mind if I read that?
Please.
In 3 days, he told himself, I shall be in Las Casas. I shall have confessed and been absolved. And the thought of the child on the rubbish heap came automatically back to him with painful love. What was the good of confession when you loved the result of your crime?
Right. There's so much going on here. I do think, David, that you're onto something about the counterfeit, but I think I'm interpreting this as everything has been stripped away except the primitive cross in his mind. And he has a choice in this moment, or he's about to face a choice. He hasn't had to face it yet, but he's about to face a choice. Am I going to go back to the counterfeit, or am I going to go forward for the 3 days, right? The 3 days he's going to be in Las Casas, or he's going to, you know, he's going to go to martyrdom and walk the Via Dolorosa like Christ.
Yeah. I feel like we're kind of like, we're in a little bit of a gray, it's not a gray area. It's just, there's so many things happening at this moment that we're kind of zinging to a variety of different explanations. And I think the variety of them account for like different kind of like shifting themes within the story.
Right. Right. Because that's, I mean, a lot of these questions on this thread are about the subtext that are entirely interpretive.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Hey, Heidi, let's go to the next question. The naming throughout the book, it says, I'd love to have more. So this is Jill Corser. Now that we're through the book, I'd love to hear more about the naming / anonymity. Why do we know certain characters' names but not others? And the last scene where the new priest arrives is interrupted before he can say his name. Perfect. So her question is naming and anonymity. Why are certain characters' names given but others not? The only ones that I remember not being given were the whiskey priest and the priest that arrives on the last page. Are there others that I'm not thinking of?
Well, the lieutenant.
The lieutenant.
And the mestizo.
Yeah.
I was going to say that. Half-caste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the three main characters.
Gosh, right.
So why is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Well, let me ask you this. Does it matter?
I think it matters. Go ahead, Tim.
I think it adds to kind of like a sense of mythos in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, the characters are unnamed. I don't think it just gives them an everyman quality. I would say it gives them a sort of almost like it inflates their shadow or inflates their personas so that they seem to loom larger over the named characters.
Mm-hmm. It's also role-based, right? Like the lieutenant is known for what lieutenants do and the whiskey priest is known for, you know, what priests do, but also with that tag to it, right?
Yeah.
How people understand them and see them and know them is kind of, the names that they are given is sort of irrelevant. They're not really part of who they are anymore. Mm-hmm. They're defined by something different than what they've been called or named or whatever. And there's something like pretty tragic about that as well, actually.
Yeah, I agree.
So do you think that there is a Beatles bathroom somewhere in this book? Because the next question is, what's the deal with the Beatles? They were exploding under feet and against walls. This is from Kim. Too much for me to ignore, but I have no idea what to make of it.
Man, I hear Kim on this. Like, so often the Beatles were exploding against the wall. And just when you think you're done with the Beatles, they're exploding against the wall and under feet. But I don't think there's anything else going on here. I think it's just like the dog gnawing on the bone. It might just be simply that.
Well, I actually prefer that reading to like the symbology of it. But isn't the beetle like there's something in Egypt or something that the beetle matters spiritually or something that maybe he's borrowing from?
The scarab kind of like thing.
If we Google it, maybe we can find something.
Maybe.
So you like the one way you could read it is exactly what Tim says. Like there's, or if you want to dig deeper, you can Google it and you can, I mean, a lot of these things he probably was familiar enough with the symbol, but here's the thing, like a symbol, there's a reason why symbols attain a certain degree of meaning, right? And because they are rooted to something real. The image, like a poet puts an image in there because it, for a very specific reason, to express something very specific and very narrow. And then that takes on the context of some symbolism throughout a tradition. So my guess is like, whether it's in Egypt or whether it's in Mexico, the Beatles take on a certain degree of symbolism that is meaningful only because of their existence in reality, right? So like the Beatles are, because the Beatles mean something in real life, they can mean something as a symbol. They take that on over the course of time and over the course of tradition.
Yeah.
So I actually think you have to start for you, it's one thing for me to go out and to research it and be like, well, the beetle, there's the scarab, there's this Egypt thing. And like, there's, you can create this equation and it means a very specific thing, right? You can, I can state that sort of like, I can say that as a fact, but it doesn't mean anything unless I start where you're talking, Tim.
Right.
Unless I recognize it as a thing in the story that has meaning in and of itself, aside from the symbolism of it, aside from the symbology of it, it has to mean something there first for it to actually matter that it means something archetypal. And right. So I think that, like, I'm not saying the question's not good, but I think the first place we have to start when you're reading something like this is with the area that, with the place that Tim is trying to narrow in on.
Right. Well, I think that, I think you're right. And I also think sometimes as, I mean, you guys know this, you're writers. Sometimes something just adds to the atmosphere in as you're imagining it in a story and you're not sure why, but then if you write it into your poem or into your story in some way, it does take on a life, right? And I'll give you an example that actually has to do with bugs. So I wrote this short story because
It's called The Spider Bathroom.
It's called The Spider Bathroom. I do have this, you guys can try to figure out my bug thing. So I had heard this story. This is a true story from history that there's this area in Southeast Colorado that during the Dust Bowl, during the years of the Great Depression, it was overwhelmed. Like there was like a locust infestation in this area where all these small towns were in Colorado. And so there's grasshoppers, like millions of them. And there's no crops anyway, but there's these grasshoppers starving, like, and they were out there and just attacking people. And they were giant, like 2-inch long, gross locusts. So the National Guard came in with flamethrowers to try to kill all these locusts because they were spreading disease. And it, that story just captured my imagination. I just, the image of these grasshoppers, like just attacking these small towns that were already devastated by famine that were then, that caused so much further devastation that they were attacked by this army of people. There's something about that. And as, because I didn't know why it captured my imagination, kind of wrote, and then the story came out of it. Right. So sometimes, and I think the Beatles have a little bit of that quality that maybe they add to this idea, whether they're symbolic or not, I don't know, but they in some ways add to this idea of like this surplus of life that can just be easily crunched underfoot by the people there that don't matter, that are exploding into the walls and no one cares because it's so hot and so oppressive.
Yeah.
Right. So it adds to the atmosphere of this oppressive story about power and filth and vermin, right?
And it's such a powerful image, and it conveys the atmosphere of Mexico so profoundly that it has sort of like an aroma of a symbol.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. Like I could see him writing it like these beetles. I mean, I have no idea how this happened, but As writers, you can see yourself doing that, right? Like you come up with this poem and then something kind of makes its way in there because it adds to the atmosphere. It's not really a symbol, but it matters a lot.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if you are putting something, if a writer, a poet, a writer, whatever sort of art you're doing, if you're putting something in there to be a symbol, you're wasting everybody's time.
Right.
That's my opinion. So like, think about it. Like, so I just sent Heidi a poem today that I'm working on actually. And it's right now it's pretty bad, but it's like the concept is I was thinking about how when I was a kid, we had this snow day. It was literally negative 50 degrees outside in Wisconsin. Couldn't go to school. And I remember standing up in my parents' bedroom on the second floor, looking down on the street, which was normally pretty busy, and watching these cars go by at like 3 miles an hour, like because there's ice everywhere. And I remember turning to my dad and saying, when we go to heaven, I was probably 8 or something. When we go to heaven, will we know that we're there? Like, well, I'm asking this question about consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember like being aware of it for the first time at that point. And like these questions began to really bother me. So I started writing this poem about that. And then I started thinking about, I was just kind of laying out the situation that there's this storm and it got me. And while the storm was there, it got me thinking about these weighty issues, right? Mm-hmm. Then I started thinking about how I started just kind of exploring that. And as I'm exploring it, it starts to become clear that the image of like the big storm blowing in and blowing away like innocence or something and bringing in these deep questions is kind of an interesting image. But I'm not sitting there thinking, I've got to come up with a symbol that's going to express how as a kid I started thinking about complicated things, right? If I'm doing that, that's not art.
Right. It's contrived. Right. Yes.
And so like those, so it kind of, it became an image that was both useful and interesting to me to explore, but it's not a symbol, you know, right now. I mean, maybe it becomes a symbol when it becomes part of the context of the tradition. Right. And so maybe it's a symbol, but like an artist does not create symbols. An artist creates images. Mm-hmm. A symbol is something that is represented by the tradition as part of a conversation. And no artist no real artist, in my opinion, I'm just putting this strongly, goes out there to create symbols. Artists don't deal in symbols. They deal in images.
Right.
And I think that that's what it becomes a symbol. Well, I've said it already. It becomes a symbol because of the tradition.
Right. Well, and the Beatles are a great example of that idea of an image that there's, like, it's particularly powerful when it's used in The Power and the Glory. There's something about that, like these deep pattering little creatures, but they're still just this, they're gross, but they're somehow connected to the land. Like there's a lot of emotional weight to the Beatles, the same way there is to, you know, the locust devastating a devastating land or whatever, however it is that we use those, or the snow day that connects to these existential questions that we have. And make it into what we write.
I love, Tim, that you said the aroma of a symbol, because something gets the aroma of a symbol when it enhances the aroma, like the specific aromas of the story.
Yeah. Mm.
And so I love that you used that word. That's great. Mm. Should we move on or should we linger here?
Yeah, I just want to observe something to you, David. This is something like for the last 2 weeks, this has been really important to you, this distinction between symbol and image. And I like that. I appreciate that draw that you have, like back to like find the reality in the text that we're reading. Symbols later, the reality first. I think that's just such a great habit of a good reader.
Well, one of the reasons that matters to me, I think, is because I've been thinking a lot more about like, what does it mean to teach literature? We're thinking about that all the time, right? That's like the constant thing that's on our mind, but also, you know, also to write it and to take part in it and all that. And I think that when you trade primarily in symbols, that's when you start that. If you believe that symbols are the ultimate reality of literature or any kind of art, then the only way that you can approach it is by being the interpreter and the memorizer and the communicator of symbolism, right? But like, you have to have like the only way you can do it then, the only way you can experience it then is if you have the person who can do all that decoding for you. But but anybody can read literature and like anybody can take part in it, and you don't need to have all that memorized and you don't need to know how to decode all of that to take part in it. And that's sort of something that matters to me. And that's, I think, what we teach our students that, well, go ahead.
I think this, like what you're advocating for is such a great way to view the Bible, which is, I mean, for all of us who are Christians, it is so tempting to read the Bible as just sort of like layer upon layer upon layer of symbol. So it's tempting to forget that, let's say in the 7 days of creation, on the seventh day, God rested. It's very tempting to read that as sort of like a symbolic of all sorts of things, symbolic of heaven, symbolic of, you know, the establishment of the Sabbath, et cetera, et cetera. But if you think about the people who were, the people who are telling the story to themselves are Israelites that are leaving Egypt, searching for the promised land, and they're wandering and wandering and wandering over blasted terrains. And all they do is walk, you know, with their lives on their back. Then like the possibility of just resting you know, like no symbol needed. Just the possibility of resting has got to sound terrifically appealing. You know, mm-hmm. that to me is sort of like that basic drive toward, let's call it court realism. That will reading, especially for me, the Old Testament with a basic drive toward realism is the most illuminating way to read the Bible, because it's so hard for me. I don't know if it is for you guys to read my Bible without having like 1800 voices in the back of my head saying, this is what the seventh day of creation means. This is what this number in Numbers means. This is what, you know, all these different things. And a lot of it can just be the simplest explanation is, well, what would it like feel like? What would the promise of this event be to the people who are actually in the story? Before you start adding on the symbols on top of that, mm-hmm. on top of that story.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I don't want to say that, like, I'm not saying symbolism or like thinking about symbols or the tradition, all that kind of stuff is meaningless or it's not worth addressing. I'm just talking about where we start. And I think that,
absolutely.
So because what you, the symbols and stuff allow for a degree of conversation and they allow for the tradition to expand and evolve and for the way we talk about literature and art to kind of evolve and expand as well. But I think I'm with you on that, because when you, like what images allow us to do is to read difficult things within the context of human experience. Mm-hmm. And some symbols tend to make human, images that provide the human context, and they tend to take those and they tend to abstract them. Because what you have to do for a symbol to have, for something to have a symbol, it has to have a name, essentially. I mean, like for us to be able to tread in, for us to be able to communicate via symbols, we have to have a way of speaking them. Images don't have to be named. They can sort of be in the realm of the abstract because they're constantly sort of like, I'm getting into like some complicated stuff here. I'm trying to find the right words to do this in like one sentence so we can move on. So maybe it's something we should say, but I think that the more precise and the less abstract we can get, the better.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you're getting at there.
Right.
That's a habit. I mean, it's a habit of a good writer, and I think it should transfer. It's like the first habit of a good reader is look for that image first, whether or not it has like a representative significance, i.e. a symbol. That's a second tier. Important, absolutely important, but it's a second action rather than a first action.
Yeah, I mean, the symbology of it suggests that there's something specific you're looking for, whereas the image allows for the interpretation of human experience, or that is human experience. Mm-hmm. So you and I are going to bring, I'm not, you know, this isn't like relativism, but you and I are going to bring different things to something, and images will mean different things to us. And that allows us each to participate in the life of that work before we have to start making it so particular that it excludes us.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on, because I could talk about this forever.
Me too.
Okay. Let's see here. Okay. Here, there's one that was, someone mentioned a lighter one. This is Erica. What's with the use of the word giggling when describing the whiskey priest's interactions? The priest is often giggling, and in several places it just felt like the wrong term to me. Out of place or off, but surely it was intentional. Is it awkwardness? Is it the alcohol? Is it supposed to give insight into his character? Did anyone else notice this? Mm-hmm. A couple of people said that they wondered the same thing and it bothered them.
Tim, go.
I took it as nervousness. Oh no, I took it as nervousness and another instance of the whiskey priest not being someone like he's not Atticus Finch. Hmm. Can you imagine Atticus? I mean, Atticus Finch is such a lovely, giggled. Wonderful. Yeah, you like no, that's just not gonna happen. It's another example of the whiskey priest is inadequate to his task, and yet completely adequate to his task. Mm-hmm. That's how I took it.
Yeah, that's great. That was exactly, I thought a lot this past week after our conversation last week about the hero, the traditional hero, and is Graham Greene subverting this? What does a saint mean? That whole conversation that we had over the last few weeks about the heroism or lack thereof of the priest, and the giggling question to me ties into that maybe more than anything else. Now, I wouldn't say it's a symbol, because like a symbol is part of collective consciousness, but in some ways it's an objective correlative, which is a way of saying in some kind of object or physical action, like a giggle, that captures something fundamentally true about what's going on in an embodied sense. Right. So the giggle makes him not only, it doesn't just humanize him. It's not just that he's not Achilles or Atticus Finch. It's that he's slightly ridiculous now, because he's a grown man and a priest giggling at inappropriate moments. So he makes himself socially inappropriate through that action. And it's very obvious in some sense that he's losing respect of the people around him, people from his own parish, from Concepcion, because of it. So I think that's exactly it. It undermines his dignity, but as Graham Greene is so brilliant at doing that, becomes then a paradox that resolves in the fact that he has this ultimate dignity in this story. He attains that in some way too. Right. But that is, I don't like... Like someone who giggles at inappropriate moments, I'm slightly judgmental of those kinds of people. So
slightly.
Just slightly, because I'm nice. But maybe I'm like, pull it together.
Get it together. Get it together, man.
Yeah. I think that's exactly what's happening. It's another way that he's subverting the traditional hero's role in just in action. It's kind of brilliant writing, actually.
I also think that giggling is both more precise and way less precise than the word laughter. And I love that about it. Like in some ways it feels like a little kid, and then in other ways it could mean so many, it could be, someone could laugh, could giggle in so many different ways that it's kind of like, it's both hilarious and terrible, terrifying at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Dan wants to know, can the first prison scene be a picture of death rather than Gethsemane? Using Angelina's lessons about symbols, well, for death, that's what it seemed like to me, and that there were many other souls down there with him. Okay, so I like that he asks, can it be a picture of death rather than Gethsemane? And then mentions the idea of symbols, because there is sort of there's the relationship between the two things. It's like the image and the symbols do go together, ultimately. It's just kind of where you start. So I actually kind of like this idea, this idea that it's a, like a cave or a tomb or something like that. And that there were many other souls down there with him. Tim, what do you think of this?
Did we say that this was Gethsemane?
Cause yeah, I didn't remember that saying that either.
Okay. Cause I don't think of
Heidi, you did say that?
Saying that.
Well, I did say that these two chapters were Gethsemane like for sure.
Well, it just goes to prove we all know that Tim and I don't actually listen when you speak. So
Oh no.
But I did refer more to the Gethsemane as being in the chapter before the Last Supper. No, that's not true. I did say this was a Gethsemane scene, but I think that death works as well.
Be both.
Yeah. I was going to say death works as well. These symbols are, and these images, these ideas are so fluid. They're moving in and out from each other. Of course. I mean, if you're trapped in darkness and you can't get out thinking about death, go ahead and call it a death-like, tomb-like image, right? I think we are supposed to, that's a strong statement. I think we're supposed to be thinking about this as a continual death of self of the priest. So yes, this is a death image for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, there's the Hades image in there.
Mm-hmm. Dante. Then, yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You just said Dante. I was going to make a reference to Dante. When I read, let's say, the Paradiso, all of it, but especially the Paradiso, it is the symbols that are incorporated into that epic are so precise. They are almost like geometrically arranged with each other. And if you displace one symbol, Mm-hmm. Well, the entire kind of structure of the paradise becomes a little bit wobbly. And I think by juxtaposition, what Graham Greene does with symbols is it's, how do you use the word fluid? I think that's exactly right. It's they're elastic, they're fluid. It's not a structure.
Yeah, it doesn't all fall down.
Yeah, it doesn't all fall down. And it's really hard to say the prison surely means this. Well, it could mean Gethsemane. It could be Jesus's descent into, you know, that's referenced in, is it 1 Peter chapter 2, where he goes to preach to the soldiers in prison. I mean, it could be that, but it's like, it's potent because Graham Greene is so good at painting these pictures. It becomes really potent, but it's hard to kind of like nail down. Okay, we know that this definitely strictly corresponds with that. Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's not the kind of symbology that he's trafficking in.
Right, right. Well, and like a lot of moderns, he's drawing on the emotional weight of situations, right? If this, even something like the Beatles that we were just talking about, this applies over here too, that there's like Beatles are gross. Nobody likes Beatles. So we feel something when we read about them being smashed against the wall. Yes, that's true. Actually, my daughter does too, and spiders. So kids are weird.
Yeah, so, exactly. Don't trust them.
But that be to your point that the feeling we get when we read about these people being shoved together in a room, in a cell, that's a death-like feeling. So it kind of draws on our collective unconsciousness about death, but also the Christian images and symbols that are universally acknowledged. Lots of crosses and lots of 3 days and lots of things that if you're paying attention, you're going to connect it with the faith. And then also just how scared you would feel. Like he's just so brilliant. Graham Greene is so brilliant. Mm-hmm. And if this particular scene has a particular emotional weight to it.
Yeah.
There's blindness, there's darkness, there's just so much there that if the question is, can I read it like ... The answer is probably going to be yes.
Yeah, right. Probably. Right.
It's man, I'm going to have to think about to what extent I think Graham Greene is trying to present a set of symbols in that scene. Mm-hmm. Because I don't really think that he is. Unless Dante tries to do it in a certain way, but even Dante, you can read. I actually think we're getting at something here that I think is a flaw in Dante. But I think that Dante, you can still read for a narrative. And you can still read it for the human experience of it and it can be really meaningful, even if you don't know every like historical figure or, you know, what every symbol represents.
Sure.
And so I wonder here, is he writing, is he trying to actually trade in the symbolism of the moment or is what's happening that he is writing this scene that's very human and he is...
Right.
And then because he does that, because it actually is human, because he manages to capture that, it manages to express things in terms that allows us to draw on symbols that have been part of our literary heritage for a long time. You know what I'm saying? Like, is he...
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's probably more like what he's trying to do there. So I don't know that we should read... I don't know. I mean, I think... Because if he's trying to write a specific symbol in, then it can't be both Gethsemane and death, right? But if he's trying to create an image that can be meaningful to us within our own human experience, both of those things can be totally meaningful and both work within the literary heritage that we've got to draw on.
Right. I think that's got to be it. Because so much of Graham Greene is like that. That his work is so rich and dense and deeply layered with very emotionally loaded and intellectually weighted content. And he knew that, right? So I don't think he just tried to like shove a bunch of stuff in there and say, figure it out, do what you want with it. I don't think that's it. But he is weaving a tapestry that has a lot of threads and colors in it that is, if the question is, did he do it on purpose, which is my least favorite question in the whole world about books. My students ask me that all the time. Do you think Shakespeare did that on purpose? And I'm like, yes, actually. Just because you thought of it today doesn't mean that he did it by accident. Like, so
that's so good. So good, Heidi.
Or the answer is it doesn't matter.
Right. Which is another answer for sure, because, you know, it depends on what angle you're going to take. So
even if you think that the author did intend to do that, like, do I really want my students to think about it that way?
Right.
That's a question. Yes. Sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. Like, I'm not saying that we shouldn't care what the author tried to do, nor should we try to ascertain that, that we shouldn't be interested in that. That's all. I love that kind of stuff. But it doesn't mean, like, it's not the only way of reading it, and it might not be the best use of the conversation in a given moment. Absolutely. With your students. Absolutely.
Completely agree. Well, and I think with Graham Greene, no author is going to write a story about people locked in a dark room and not think, well, maybe they'll think it's a death image, right? Like, that is right. In the nature of how he drew this particular chapter. Mm. But there's lots of other things going on too.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. Lauren wants to know, is it significant that in the priest's final dream, he doesn't take the host, but receives the cup, the wine? Yes, it is. I was reminded that the host is the body that was broken for you, quote, but the wine is the sign of the new covenant and that it will be drunk with Christ in the kingdom. Would that make sense with this part of the story, as in the priest's sin has been paid for by Christ's blood and he can enter the kingdom?
I think she answered the question better than I was going to say.
I think we can just say sure.
Yeah, and it's a great. Unless Heidi disagrees. Question.
No, I totally agree with that, and I think it's a reference to martyrdom too, like the spilling of blood. Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go. Let's go. We're going to finish with this one, and then I've got a question for you as we finish up. Which do you think benefits the church more, the idealized hagiographies that praise courage and holiness, or the brutally honest stories that show failures and sin? On the one hand, you said the hagiography speaks truth to power and illuminates virtue, but on the other hand, more realistic stories can make us feel like those virtues are attainable to the common man. Which do you think is most helpful to the body of believers? We're talking ideal types here, right?
Yes. I was going to say, if Matt Bianco was on this show as he wanted to be, he would answer that definitively.
We'll have to do a bonus conversation with Matt Bianco where we talk about ideal types. So should we save that question for a bonus pod?
Sure.
I'm great with that.
All right, let's do that. Let's save it. We'll get Matt on sometime and we'll record 30 or 40 or minutes or hours on that topic with with Matt Bianco, because he has much to say about that. And on the Forma, if you subscribe to Forma in the next couple of weeks, possibly this week, depending on what happens with my child, then we will be posting a conversation that Heidi and Matt had about ideal types. So if you subscribe, that will go via email to as a subscriber exclusive. And remember, you can do that for the same price that it costs you to buy one of those terrible old pumpkin spice lattes,
or one of Heidi's gas station,
or lattes. Four gasachinos, four
right, or
a taquito. Do I hear a taquito?
Or
I
do some like
taquitos,
or some,
and some Jolly Ranchers,
or some Old Spice deodorant, which was what I was almost going to say. So Matt just walked in the room. But Matt, we're going to do a bonus pod with you where we can just focus on that for the whole time, because we're almost out of time. We'd only be able to do 5 minutes on it now. So we're going to have you on to do a whole podcast on that. I think that should be hot. Yeah.
I was just walking down the hallway and I heard my name taken in vain. And I was like, what is going on in there?
Nobody was taking your name in vain. We were saying we need a whole conversation with you.
Bonus podcast.
Okay.
All right.
That'll be two now though, because we have to do that other one for
Lear.
Yeah. Well, someday.
I'm up for it.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll do that soon. Okay. Here's my last question for each of you then. This is The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene. We've talked a lot about Graham Greene, but we have not talked a lot about his other work. What book would you each recommend that people turn to if they want to read some more Graham Greene? What's the next thing that you would recommend? Tim, I'll let you go first on that.
The End of the Affair.
Give me one sentence of description or one sentence reason why, or defense of why.
Oh, it's a great story. That's a terrible answer. It's a terrible answer. It is beautiful because I think it takes a traditional view of faith and it puts it in contrast with someone who seemingly cannot understand. And it casts them in love with each other. That's ripe.
Heidi, what would you say? What book?
So I'm not as familiar with the Graham Greene canon as I should be. I've only read three other of his books other than this. So I've only read four total, and I know he has a vast canon. But I absolutely concur. The End of the Affair there is a chapter in The End of the Affair that I think is the single greatest treatise on the power of the incarnation of Christ than anything I've ever read ever in my life.
You've read Athanasius.
Athanasius gives it, it's probably better, but
it's a different spin.
Yes. But do you guys know what I'm talking about, right? In The End of the Affair, when there's a character that goes into a church, it's so magnificent. And also The End of the Affair, the other great part, it has the same kind of emphasis on the cost of faith, to like what it costs a soul to be sick and be so bent in on itself, as C.S. Lewis calls it, that idea of being bent, what it costs a soul to pursue virtue when the soul is sick with sin. And The End of the Affair is an exploration of that. And it's just very lovely. It's a bit explicit because it's about an affair. So be
plus
warned.
It's shorter than The Power and the Glory.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in support of short books.
Yeah.
My recommendation would come as no surprise to anybody. It's one of Graham Greene's spy novels, and it's called, he's got a couple. He wrote a novella called The Third Man, which became one of the greatest movies ever made. He actually got enlisted to write the screenplay for it. It's with Orson Welles and Joseph Cotten. And then he decided, I'll just write a novel first before I write the screenplay as an exercise. So he wrote one of the great novellas ever. But then also The Confidential Agent was one of the best early spy novels that led the way for Le Carré and, the Bond stories and so many other ones. So definitely I recommend those. So the high, basically thrillers, he called them entertainments with great literary merit. So, all right. Well, next week we will be kicking off a conversation about The Great Gatsby, and that's going to be with Angelina Stanford and a special guest, Adam Andrews from the Center for Lit. He loves this book, and so we are going to be discussing that with him. Then we're going to have on the Shakespeare side, on the plays, The Thing, we are going to be doing Henry V, and we're going to take a couple of weeks off just to get everything settled with my life, and then we'll come back and we'll do Henry V, and I believe that's going to be the three of us on that, right?
Yeah, I'm excited.
Okay, cool. And Tim, is that true? Did I make that up just on the spot right there? I think I made it up. He seems to be not there. but I'm pretty sure that's it. So, and then also don't forget.
Got jumbled. I did not hear what you said because my internet got jumbled.
I was just talking about that you're going to be on Henry V with us, right?
I think you made that up, David.
Wait.
I can't tell what's actually happening right now. But
I don't know either.
So, okay. So then there's
we are going to do Henry V.
We're going to do Henry V. Yeah. And then there's going to be, Tim just texted me, don't ask me anything else. My interweb is dying. So yeah, we're gonna do that. Don't forget about the daily poem, and don't forget about a lot of the other content we have. Forma has lots of great content, and we're also gonna be launching, I'm just gonna make an announcement here, we're gonna be launching a show called Libromania, which is gonna be a podcast for book nerds. I'm gonna be interviewing authors about their own books and their own process. I'm going to be interviewing people about the lives of famous authors. I'm gonna be interviewing people about book nerd stuff like book design, why books smell the way they do. So book science, book design, book layout, book cover design, all that kind of stuff, running a library, working in a bookstore. So it's going to be all kinds of stuff that's related to just book obsession. So that feed will be up soon and you can subscribe to that, but I wanted to get let you guys, all of you who listen to Close Reads, know that that is coming. And with that, that's it. Heidi, do you have anything else you want to add?
I have nothing else to add.
Okay. All right. Well, for Tim, who has disappeared into the worldwide web.
Into
the real world. Yeah. And for Heidi White and for all of us here at the Close Reads Network and at the Cersei Institute, thanks so much for listening. And we will be back next week as we begin our conversation of The Great Gatsby. Happy reading.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.